he said, chortling, still holding on to her in a drawn-out hug. She laughed. He was so small, so innocent, and yet there was a precociousness about him, but it was a sunny one. He did not nurse dark intentions about the adults in his world. That night, after he and Auntie Uju got into bed, and Ifemelu settled on a blanket on the floor, he said,
"How come she has to sleep on the floor, Mom? We can all fit in."
As though he could sense how Ifemelu felt. There was nothing wrong with the arrangement. She had, after all, slept on mats when she visited her grandmother in the village. But this was America at last. Glorious America at last. And she had not expected to bed on the floor. "I'm fine, Diki," she said. He got up and brought her his pillow.
"Here, it's soft and comfy."
Auntie Uju said, "Diki, come and lie down. Let your auntie sleep." Ifemelu could not sleep, her mind too alert to the newness of things, and she waited to hear Auntie Uju snoring before she slipped out of the room and turned on the kitchen light. A fat cockroach was perched on the wall near the cabinets, moving slightly up and down as though breathing heavily. If she had been in their Lagos kitchen, she would have found a broom and killed it. But she left the American cockroach alone and went and stood by the living room window. Flatlands, Auntie Uju said this section of Brooklyn was called. The street below was poorly lit, bordered not by leafy trees, but by closely parked cars. Nothing like the pretty street on the Cosby Show. Ifemelu stood there for a long time, her body unsure of itself, overwhelmed by a sense of newness. But she felt also a frisson of expectation, an eagerness to discover America.
"I think it's better if you take care of DK for the summer and save me babysitting money, and then start looking for a job when you get to Philadelphia," Auntie Uju said the next morning.
She had woken Ifemelu up, giving brisk instructions about DK, saying she would go to the library to study after work. Her words tumbled out. Ifemelu wished she would slow down a little.
"You can't work with your student visa, and work study is rubbish. It pays nothing, and you have to be able to cover your rent and the balance of your tuition. Me, you can see I'm working 3 jobs, and yet it's not easy. I talked to one of my friends. I don't know if you remember Ngozi Okonkwo. She's now an American citizen, and she has gone back to Nigeria for a while to start a business. I begged her, and she agreed to let you work with her social security card."
"How? I'll use her name," Ifemelu asked.
"Of course you'll use her name," Auntie Uju said,
eyebrows raised, as though she had barely stopped herself from asking if Ifemelu was stupid. There was a small white blob of face cream on her hair, caught at the root of a braid, and Ifemelu was going to tell her to wipe it off, but she changed her mind, saying nothing, and watched Auntie Uju hurry to the door. She felt singed by Auntie Uju's reproach. It was as if between them an old intimacy had quite suddenly lapsed. Auntie Uju's impatience, that new prickliness in her, made Ifemelu feel that there were things she should already know, but through some personal failing of hers, did not know.
"There's corned beef, so you can make sandwiches for lunch,"
Auntie Uju had said, as though those words were perfectly normal and did not require a humorous preamble about how Americans ate bread for lunch. But DK didn't want a sandwich. After he had shown her all his toys, and they had watched some episodes of Tom and Jerry, with him laughing, thrilled because she had watched them all before in Nigeria, and so told him what would happen before it did, he opened the fridge and pointed at what he wanted her to make him.
"Hot dogs!" Ifemelu examined the curiously long sausages and then began to open cupboards to look for some oil.
"Mommy says I have to call you Auntie Ifem, but you're not my aunt. You're my cousin."
"So call me cousin."
"Okay, cuz,"
DK said, and laughed. His laughter was so warm, so open. She had found the vegetable oil.
"You don't need oil," DK said. "You just cook the hot dog in water."
"Water? How can a sausage be cooked in water?"
"It's a hot dog, not a sausage."
Of course it was a sausage, whether or not they called it the ludicrous name of hot dog, and so she fried 2 in a little oil, as she was used to doing with Satis sausages. DK looked on in horror. She turned the stove off.
He backed away and said,
"Ah!"
They stood looking at each other, between them a plate with a bun and two shriveled hot dogs. She knew then that she should have listened to him.
"Can I have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich instead?"
DK asked. She followed his instructions for the sandwich, cutting off the bread crusts, layering on the peanut butter first, stifling her laughter at how closely he watched her, as though she just might decide to fry the sandwich. When that evening Ifemelu told Auntie Uju about the hot dog incident, Auntie Uju said with none of the amusement Ifemelu had expected, "They are not sausages, they are hot dogs." "It's like saying that a bikini is not the same thing as underwear. Would a visitor from space know the difference?" Auntie Uju shrugged. She was sitting at the dining table, a medical textbook open in front of her, eating a hamburger from a rumpled paper bag. Her skin dry, her eyes shadowed, her spirit bleached of color. She seemed to be staring at, rather than reading, the book. At the grocery store, Auntie Uju never bought what she needed. Instead, she bought what was on sale and made herself need it. She would take the colorful flyer at the entrance of Key Food and go looking for the sale items, aisle after aisle, while Ifemelu wheeled the cart and Dike walked along.
"Mummy, I don't like that. Get the blue one,"
Dike said as Auntie Uju put cartons of cereal in the cart. "It's buy one, get one free," Auntie Uju said.
"It doesn't taste good."
"It tastes just like your regular cereal, DK."
"No."
DK took a blue carton from the shelf and hurried ahead to the checkout counter. "Hi, little guy." The cashier was large and cheerful, her cheeks reddened and peeling from sunburn. "Helping Mommy out, DK?" "Pour it back," Auntie Uju said, with a nasal sliding accent she put on when she spoke to white Americans, in the presence of white Americans, in the hearing of white Americans. "Pour it back." And with the accent emerged a new persona, apologetic and self-abasing. She was over-eager with the cashier.
Sorry,
she said as she fumbled to get her debit card from her wallet. Because the cashier was watching, Auntie Uju let DK keep the cereal. But in the car, she grabbed his left ear and twisted it, yanked it.
"I have told you. Do not ever take anything in the grocery. Do you hear me? Or do you want me to slap you before you hear?"
DK pressed his palm to his ear. Auntie Uju turned to Ifemelu. "This is how children like to misbehave in this country. Jane was even telling me that her daughter threatens to call the police when she beats her. Imagine. I don't blame the girl. She has come to America and learned about calling the police." Ifemelu rubbed DK's knee. He did not look at her. Auntie Uju was driving a little too fast. DK called out from the bathroom, where he had been sent to brush his teeth before bed.
"DK, imechago?" Ifemelu asked. "Please, don't speak Igbo to him," Auntie Uju said. "Two languages will confuse him." "What are you talking about, Auntie? We spoke two languages growing up." "This is America. It's different."
Ifemelu held her tongue. Auntie Uju closed her medical book and stared ahead at nothing. The television was off, and the sound of water running came from the bathroom.
"Auntie,
what is it?" Ifemelu asked.
"What is wrong?"
"What do you mean?"
"Nothing is wrong,"
Auntie Uju sighed.
"I failed my last exam. I got the result just before you came."
"Oh," Ifemelu was watching her.
"I've never failed an exam in my life. But they weren't testing actual knowledge. They were testing our ability to answer tricky multiple-choice questions that have nothing to do with real medical knowledge."
She stood up and went to the kitchen.
"I'm tired. I'm so tired. I thought by now things would be better for me and DK. It's not as if anybody was helping me, and I just could not believe how quickly money went. I was studying and working three jobs. I was doing retail at the mall, and a research assistantship, and I even did some hours at Burger King."
"It will get better," Ifemelu said helplessly. She knew how hollow she sounded. Nothing was familiar. She was unable to comfort Auntie Uju, because she did not know how. When Auntie Uju spoke about her friends who had come to America earlier and passed their exams, Nkechi in Maryland had sent her the dining set. Kemi in Indiana bought her the bed. Osavisa had sent crockery and clothes from Hartford. Ifemelu said, God bless them. And the words felt bulky and useless in her mouth. She had assumed from Auntie Uju's calls home that things were not too bad, although she realized now that Auntie Uju had always been vague, mentioning work and exam without details. Or perhaps it was because she had not asked for details, had not expected to understand details. And she thought, watching her, how the old Auntie Uju would never have worn her hair in such scruffy braids. She would never have tolerated the ingrown hair that grew like raisins on her chin, or worn trousers that gathered bulkily between her legs. America had subdued her. Chapter 10. That first summer was Ifemelu's summer of waiting. The real America, she felt, was just around the next corner she would turn. Even the days, sliding one into the other, languorous and limpid, the sun lingering until very late, seemed to be waiting. There was a stripped-down quality to her life, a kindling starkness, without parents and friends and home, the familiar landmarks that made her who she was. And so she waited, writing Obinze long, detailed letters, calling him once in a while. Calls kept brief, because Auntie Uju said she could not waste the phone card, and spending time with Dike. He was a mere child, but she felt with him a kinship close to friendship. They watched his favorite cartoon shows together, Rugrats and Franklin, and they read books together, and she took him out to play with Jane's children. Jane lived in the next apartment. She and her husband Marlon were from Grenada, and spoke in a lyrical accent as though just about to break into song. They are like us. He has a good job, and he has ambition, and they spank their children, Auntie Uju had said approvingly. Ifemelu and Jane laughed when they discovered how similar their childhoods in Grenada and Nigeria had been, with Enid Blyton books and Anglophile teachers and fathers who worshipped the BBC World Service. She was only a few years older than Ifemelu. I married very young. Everybody wanted Marlon, so how could I say no? She said, half-teasing. They would sit together on the front steps of the building and watch DK and Jane's children, Elizabeth and Junior, ride their bicycles to the end of the street and then back. Ifemelu often calling out to DK not to go any farther, the children shouting, the concrete sidewalks gleaming in the hot sun, and the summer lull disrupted by the occasional rise and fall of loud music from passing cars. Things must still be very strange for you, Jane said. Ifemelu nodded. Yes. An ice cream van drove into the street, and with it a tinkling melody. You know, this is my 10th year here, and I feel as if I'm still settling in, Jane said. The hardest thing is raising my kids. Look at Elizabeth. I have to be very careful with her. If you are not careful in this country, your children become what you don't know. It's different back home, because you can control them. Here, no. Jane wore an air of harmlessness, with her plain face and jiggly arms, but there was, beneath her ready smile, an icy watchfulness. How old is she? 10? Ifemelu asked. 9, and already trying to be a drama queen. We pay good money for her to go to private school because the public schools here are useless. Marlon says we'll move to the suburbs soon, so they can go to better schools. Otherwise she will start behaving like these black Americans. What do you mean? Don't worry. You will understand with time, Jane said, and got up to get some money for the children's ice cream. Ifemelu looked forward to sitting outside with Jane, until the evening Marlon came back from work and told Ifemelu in a hasty whisper, after Jane went in to get some lemonade for the children, I've been thinking about you. I want to talk to you. She did not tell Jane. Jane would never hold Marlon responsible for anything, her light-skinned, hazel-eyed Marlon, whom everyone wanted. And so Ifemelu began to avoid both of them, to design elaborate board games that she and DK could play indoors. Once, she asked DK what he had done in school before summer, and he said, circles. They would sit on the floor in a circle and share their favorite things. She was appalled. Can you do division?
He looked at her strangely.
I'm only in first grade, cuz.
When I was your age, I could do simple division. The conviction lodged in her head that American children learned nothing in elementary school, and it hardened when he told her that his teacher sometimes gave out homework coupons. If you got a homework coupon, then you could skip one day of homework. Circles, homework coupons, what foolishness would she next hear? And so she began to teach him mathematics. She called it maths, and he called it math, and so they agreed not to shorten the word. She could not think now of that summer without thinking of long division, of DK's brows furrowed in confusion as they sat side by side at the dining table, of her swings from bribing him to shouting at him, "Okay, try it one more time, and you can have ice cream. You're not going to play unless you get them all right." Later, when he was older, he would say that he found mathematics easy because of her summer of torturing him. "You must mean summer of tutoring," she would say, in what became a familiar joke that, like comfort food, they would reach for from time to time. It was also her summer of eating. She enjoyed the unfamiliar, the McDonald's hamburgers with the brief tart crunch of pickles, a new taste that she liked on one day and disliked on the next. The wraps Auntie Uju brought home, wet with piquant dressing, and the bologna and pepperoni that left a film of salt in her mouth. She was disoriented by the blandness of fruits, as though nature had forgotten to sprinkle some seasoning on the oranges and the bananas, but she liked to look at them and to touch them. Because bananas were so big, so evenly yellow, she forgave them their tastelessness. Once, DK said,
"Why are you doing that? Eating a banana with peanuts?"
"That's what we do in Nigeria. Do you want to try?"
"No,"
he said firmly.
"I don't think I like Nigeria, cuz."
Ice cream was fortunately a taste unchanged. She scooped straight from the buy-one-get-one-free giant tubs in the freezer, globs of vanilla and chocolate, while staring at the television. She followed shows she had watched in Nigeria, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, A Different World, and discovered new shows she had not known, Friends, The Simpsons. But it was the commercials that captivated her. She ached for the lives they showed, lives full of bliss, where all problems had sparkling solutions in shampoos and cars and packaged foods. And in her mind, they became the real America, the America she would only see when she moved to school in the autumn. At first, the evening news puzzled her, a litany of fires and shootings, because she was used to NTA news, where self-important army officers cut ribbons or gave speeches. But as she watched, day after day, images of men being hauled off in handcuffs, distraught families in front of charred, smouldering houses, the wreckage of cars crashed in police chases, blurred videos of armed robberies in shops, her puzzlement ripened to worry. She panicked when there was a sound by the window, when DK went too far down the street on his bicycle. She stopped taking out the trash after dark because a man with a gun might be lurking outside. Auntie Uju said, laughing shortly, "If you keep watching television, you will think these things happen all the time. Do you know how much crime happens in Nigeria? Is it because we don't report it, like they do here?" Chapter 11. Auntie Uju came home dry-faced and tense, the streets dark, and DK already in bed to ask, "Do I have mail? Do I have mail?" The question always repeated, her entire being at a perilous edge, about to tip over. Some nights, she would talk on the phone for a long time, her voice hushed, as though she were protecting something from the world's prying gaze. Finally, she told Ifemelu about Bartholomew. "He is an accountant, divorced, and he is looking to settle down. He is from Eziowelle, very near us." Ifemelu, floored by Auntie Uju's words, could only say, "Oh, okay," and nothing else. "What does he do?" and "Where is he from?" were the questions her own mother would ask. But when had it started to matter to Auntie Uju that a man was from a hometown close to theirs? One Saturday, Bartholomew visited from Massachusetts.
Auntie Uju cooked peppered gizzards, powdered her face, and stood by the living room window, waiting to see his car pull in. Dike watched her, playing half-heartedly with his action figures, confused but also excited, because he could sense her expectation. When the doorbell rang, she told Dike urgently, "Behave well." Bartholomew wore khaki trousers, pulled up high on his belly, and spoke with an American accent filled with holes, mangling words until they were impossible to understand. Ifemelu sensed from his demeanor a deprived rural upbringing that he had tried to compensate for with his American affectation, his gunners and wanners. He glanced at Dike and said almost indifferently,
"Oh, yes, your boy. How are you doing?"
"Good," Dike mumbled. It irked Ifemelu that Bartholomew was not interested in the son of the woman he was courting, and did not bother to pretend that he was. He was jarringly unsuited for, and unworthy of, Auntie Uju. A more intelligent man would have realized this and tempered himself, but not Bartholomew. He behaved grandiosely, like a special prize that Auntie Uju was fortunate to have, and Auntie Uju humored him. Before he tasted the gizzards, he said,
"Let me see if this is any good."
Auntie Uju laughed, and in her laughter was a certain assent, because his words, "Let me see if this is any good," were about her being a good cook, and therefore a good wife. She had slipped into the rituals, smiling a smile that promised to be demure to him, but not to the world. Lunging to pick up his fork when it slipped from his hand, serving him more beer. Quietly, Dike watched from the dining table, his toys untouched. Bartholomew ate gizzards and drank beer. He talked about Nigerian politics with the fervid enthusiasm of a person who followed it from afar, who read and reread articles on the internet.
"Kudurat's death will not be in vain. It will only galvanize the democratic movement in a way that even her life did not. I just wrote an article about this issue online in Nigerian Village."
Auntie Uju nodded while he talked, agreeing with everything he said. Often, silence gaped between them. They watched television, a drama, predictable, and filled with brightly shot scenes, one of which featured a young girl in a short dress.
"A girl in Nigeria will never wear that kind of dress," Bartholomew said. "Look at that. This country has no moral compass."
Ifemelu should not have spoken, but there was something about Bartholomew that made silence impossible. The exaggerated caricature that he was, with his back-shaft haircut, unchanged since he came to America 30 years ago, and his false, overheated moralities. He was one of those people who in his village back home would be called lost.
"You went to America and got lost," his people would say. "He went to America and refused to come back."
"Girls in Nigeria wear dresses much shorter than that, too," Ifemelu said. "In secondary school, some of us changed in our friends' houses so our parents wouldn't know."
Auntie Uju turned to her, eyes narrow with warning. Bartholomew looked at her and shrugged, as though she was not worth responding to. Dislike simmered between them. For the rest of the afternoon, he ignored her. He would in the future often ignore her. Later, she read his online posts on Nigerian Village, all of them sour-toned and strident, under the moniker Ibo Massachusetts Accountant. And it surprised her how profusely he wrote, how actively he pursued airless arguments. He had not been back to Nigeria in years, and perhaps he needed the consolation of those online groups, where small observations flared and blazed into attacks, personal insults flung back and forth. Ifemelu imagined the writers, Nigerians in bleak houses in America, their lives deadened by work, nursing their careful savings throughout the year so that they could visit home in December for a week, when they would arrive bearing suitcases of shoes and clothes and cheap watches, and see in the eyes of their relatives brightly burnished images of themselves. Afterwards, they would return to America, to fight on the internet over their mythologies of home, because home was now a blurred place between here and there, and at least online they could ignore the awareness of how inconsequential they had become. Nigerian women came to America and became wild. Ebo, Massachusetts accountant, wrote in one post. It was an unpleasant truth, but one that had to be said. What else accounted for the high divorce rates among Nigerians in America and the low rates among Nigerians in Nigeria? Delta Mermaid replied that women simply had laws protecting them in America, and the divorce rates would be just as high if those laws were in Nigeria. Ebo, Massachusetts accountants, rejoined her.
You have been brainwashed by the West. You should be ashamed to call yourself a Nigerian.
In response to Eze Houston, who wrote that Nigerian men were cynical when they went back to Nigeria looking for nurses and doctors to marry, only so that the new wives would earn money for them back in America, Ebo, Massachusetts accountant wrote,
What is wrong with a man wanting financial security from his wife? Don't women want the same thing?
After he left that Saturday, Auntie Uju asked Ifemelu,
What did you think?
He uses bleaching creams.
What?
Couldn't you see? His face is a funny color. He must be using the cheap ones with no sunscreen.
What kind of man bleaches his skin, Biko?
Auntie Uju shrugged, as though she had not noticed the greenish-yellow tone of the man's face, worse at his temples.
He's not bad. He has a good job.
She paused.
I'm not getting any younger. I want DK to have a brother or a sister.
In Nigeria,
a man like him would not even have the courage to talk to you.
We are not in Nigeria, Ifem.
Before Auntie Uju went into the bedroom, tottering under her many anxieties, she said,
Please, just pray that it will work.
Ifemelu did not pray, but even if she did, she could not bear praying for Auntie Uju to be with Bartholomew. It saddened her that Auntie Uju had settled merely for what was familiar. Because of Obinze, Manhattan intimidated Ifemelu. The first time she took the subway from Brooklyn to Manhattan, her palms sweaty, she walked the streets, watching, absorbing, a sylph-like woman running in high heels, her short dress floating behind her, until she tripped and almost fell, a pudgy man coughing and spitting on the curb, a girl dressed all in black, raising a hand for the taxis that sliced past. The endless skyscrapers taunted the sky, but there was dirt on the building windows. The dazzling imperfection of it all calmed her.
It's wonderful, but it's not heaven, she told Obinze.
She could not wait until he, too, saw Manhattan. She imagined them both walking hand in hand, like the American couples she saw, lingering at a shop window, pausing to read menus taped on restaurant doors, stopping at a food cart to buy cold bottles of iced tea.
Soon,
he said in his letter. They said, soon, to each other often, and soon gave their plan the weight of something real. Finally, Auntie Uju's result came. Ifemelu brought in the envelope from the mailbox. So slight, so ordinary. United States Medical Licensing Examination, printed on it in even script, and held it in her hand for a long time, willing it to be good news. She raised it up as soon as Auntie Uju walked indoors. Auntie Uju gasped.
Is it thick? Is it thick?
She asked.
What, Guinea?
Ifemelu asked.
Is it thick?
Auntie Uju asked again, letting her handbag slip to the floor and moving forward, her hand outstretched, her face savage with hope. She took the envelope and shouted,
I made it!
And then opened it to make sure, peering at the thin sheet of paper.
If you fail, they send you a thick envelope so that you can re-register.
Auntie, I knew it! Congratulations!
Ifemelu said. Auntie Uju hugged her, both of them leaning into each other, hearing each other's breathing. And it brought to Ifemelu a warm memory of Lagos.
Where's Dike?
Auntie Uju asked, as though he was not already in bed when she came home from her second job. She went into the kitchen, stood under the bright ceiling light, and looked again at the result, her eyes wet.
So, I will be a family physician in this America,
she said, almost in a whisper. She opened a can of Coke and left it undrunk. Later she said, I have to take my braids out for my interviews and relax my hair. Kemi told me that I shouldn't wear braids to the interview. If you have braids, they will think you are unprofessional.
So there are no doctors with braided hair in America?
Ifemelu asked. I have told you what they told me. You are in a country that is not your own. You do what you have to do if you want to succeed.
There it was again, the strange naivete with which Auntie Uju had covered herself like a blanket. Sometimes while having a conversation, it would occur to Ifemelu that Auntie Uju had deliberately left behind something of herself, something essential, in a distant and forgotten place. Obinze said it was the exaggerated gratitude that came with immigrant insecurity. Obinze, so like him to have an explanation. Obinze, who anchored her through that summer of waiting. His steady voice over the phone, his long letters in blue airmail envelopes, and who understood, as summer was ending, the new gnawing in her stomach. She wanted to start school, to find the real America, and yet there was that gnawing in her stomach, an anxiety, and a new aching nostalgia for the Brooklyn summer that had become familiar. Children on bicycles, sinewy black men in tight white tank tops, ice cream vans tinkling, loud music from roofless cars, sun shining into night, and things rotting and smelling in the humid heat. She did not want to leave Dike. The mere thought brought a sense of treasure already lost. And yet she wanted to leave Auntie Uju's apartment and begin a life in which she alone determined the margins. Dike had once told her wistfully about his friend who had gone to Coney Island and come back with a picture taken on a steep sliding ride, and so she surprised him on the weekend before she left, saying, "We are going to Coney Island." Jane had told her what train to take, what to do, how much it would cost. Auntie Uju said it was a good idea, but gave her no money to add to what she had. As she watched Dike on the rides, screaming, terrified and thrilled, a little boy entirely open to the world, she did not mind what she had spent. They ate hot dogs and milkshakes and cotton candy.
"I can't wait until I don't have to come with you to the girls' bathroom," he told her, and she laughed and laughed. On the train back, he was tired and sleepy. "'Cause this was the bestest day ever with you," he said, resting against her.
The bittersweet glow of an ending limbo overcame her days later when she kissed DK goodbye. Once, then twice, and three times, while he cried, a child so unused to crying, and she bit back her own tears, and Auntie Uju said over and over that Philadelphia was not very far away. Ifemelu rolled her suitcase to the subway, took it to the 42nd Street terminal, and got on a bus to Philadelphia. She sat by the window. Somebody had stuck a blob of chewed gum on the pane, and spent long minutes looking again at the social security card and driver's license that belonged to Ngozi Okonkwo. Ngozi Okonkwo was at least 10 years older than she was. With a narrow face, eyebrows that started as little balls before loping into arcs, and a jaw shaped like the letter V.
"I don't even look like her at all,"
Ifemelu had said when Auntie Uju gave her the card. "All of us look alike to white people," Auntie Uju said.
Auntie,
I'm not joking. Amara's cousin came last year, and she doesn't have her papers yet, so she has been working with Amara's ID. You remember Amara? Her cousin is fair and slim. They do not look alike at all. Nobody noticed. She works as a home health aide in Virginia. Just make sure you always remember your new name. I have a friend who forgot, and one of her co-workers called her, and she was blank. Then they became suspicious and reported her to immigration.
Chapter 12. There was Ginika, standing in the small, crowded bus terminal, wearing a miniskirt and a tube top that covered her chest, but not her midriff, and waiting to scoop Ifemelu up and into the real America. Ginika was much thinner, half her old size, and her head looked bigger, balanced on a long neck that brought to mind a vague, exotic animal. She extended her arms
as though urging a child into an embrace, laughing, calling out, "Ifemsko! Ifemsko!" And Ifemelu was taken back for a moment to secondary school, an image of gossiping girls in their blue and white uniforms, felt berets perched on their heads, crowded in the school corridor. She hugged Ginnika. The theatrics of their holding each other close, disengaging and then holding each other close again, made her eyes fill, to her mild surprise, with tears.
"Look at you!" Ginnika said,
gesturing, jangling the many silver bangles around her wrist.
"Is it really you?
When did you stop eating and start looking like a dried stockfish?" Ifemelu asked. Ginnika laughed, took the suitcase, and turned to the door.
"Come on, let's go. I'm parked illegally."
The green Volvo was at the corner of a narrow street. An unsmiling woman in uniform, ticket booklet in hand, was stumping towards them when Ginnika jumped in and started the car.
"Close,"
she said, laughing. A homeless man in a grubby T-shirt, pushing a trolley filled with bundles, had stopped just by the car, as though to rest briefly, staring ahead at nothing, and Ginnika glanced at him as she eased the car into the street. They drove with the windows down. Philadelphia was the smell of the summer sun, of burnt asphalt, of sizzling meat from food carts tucked into street corners, foreign brown men and women hunched inside. Ifemelu would come to like the gyros from those carts, flatbread and lamb and dripping sauces, as she would come to love Philadelphia itself. It did not raise the specter of intimidation as Manhattan did. It was intimate, but not provincial, a city that might yet be kind to you. Ifemelu saw women on the sidewalks going to lunch from work, wearing sneakers, proof of their American preference for comfort over elegance, and she saw young couples clutching each other, kissing from time to time as if they feared that, if they unclasped their hands, their love would dissolve, melt into nothingness.
"I borrowed my landlord's car. I didn't want to come get you in my shit-ass car. I can't believe it. Ifemsko, you're in America,"
Ginnika said. There was a metallic, unfamiliar glamour in her gauntness, her olive skin, her short skirt that had risen up barely covering her crotch, her straight, straight hair that she kept tucking behind her ears, blonde streaks shiny in the sunlight.
"We're entering University City, and that's where Wilson campus is, she, you know. We can go for you to see the school first, and then we can go to my place, out in the suburbs, and after we can go to my friend's place in the evening. She's doing a get-together."
Ginnika had lapsed into Nigerian English, a dated, overcooked version, eager to prove how unchanged she was. She had, with a strenuous loyalty, kept in touch through the years, calling and writing letters and sending books and shapeless trousers she called slacks. And now she was saying, "Shay, you know?" And Ifemelu did not have the heart to tell her that nobody said "Shay" anymore. Ginnika recounted anecdotes about her own early experiences in America, as though they were all filled with subtle wisdom that Ifemelu would need. "If you see how they laughed at me in high school when I said that somebody was boning for me, because boning here means to have sex, so I had to keep explaining that in Nigeria it means carrying face. And can you imagine, half-caste is a bad word here? In freshman year, I was telling a bunch of my friends about how I was voted prettiest girl in school back home. Remember? I should never have won. Zenab should have won. It was just because I was half-caste. There's even more of that here. There's some shit you get from white people in this country that I won't get. But anyway, I was telling them about back home and how all the boys were chasing me because I was a half-caste, and they said I was dissing myself. So now I say biracial, and I'm supposed to be offended when someone says half-caste. I've met a lot of people here with white mothers, and they are so full of issues, eh? I didn't know I was even supposed to have issues until I came to America. Honestly, if anybody wants to raise biracial kids, do it in Nigeria."
"Of course, where all the boys chase the half-caste girls."
"Not all the boys, by the way," Ginnika made a face. "Obinze had better hurry up and come to the U.S. before somebody will carry you away. You know you have the kind of body they like here."
"What?"
"You're thin, with big breasts."
"Please, I'm not thin. I'm slim."
"Americans say thin. Here, thin is a good word." Is that why you stopped eating? All your bum has gone. I always wished I had a bum like yours,
Ifemelu said.
Do you know, I started losing weight almost as soon as I came. I was even close to anorexia. The kids at my high school called me pork. You know at home when somebody tells you that you lost weight, it means something bad. But here, somebody tells you that you lost weight, and you say, thank you. It's just different here,
Ginnika said, a little wistfully, as though she too were new to America. Later, Ifemelu watched Ginnika at her friend Stephanie's apartment, a bottle of beer poised at her lips, her American-accented words sailing out of her mouth, and was struck by how like her American friend's Ginnika had become. Jessica, the Japanese-American, beautiful and animated, playing with the emblemed key of her Mercedes. Pale-skinned Teresa, who had a loud laugh and wore diamond studs and shabby worn-out shoes. Stephanie, the Chinese-American, her hair a perfect swinging bob that curved inwards at her chin, who from time to time reached into her monogram bag to get her cigarettes and step out for a smoke. Hari, coffee-skinned and black-haired, and wearing a tight T-shirt, who said, I am Indian, not Indian-American, when Ginnika introduced Ifemelu. They all laughed at the same things and said, gross, about the same things. They were well choreographed. Stephanie announced that she had homemade beer in her fridge, and everyone chanted, qual. Then Teresa said, can I have the regular beer, Steph? In the small voice of a person afraid to offend. Ifemelu sat on a lone armchair at the end of the room, drinking orange juice, listening to them talk.
That company is so evil. Oh, my God, I can't believe there's so much sugar in this stuff. The Internet is totally going to change the world.
She heard Ginnika ask, did you know that they use something from animal bones to make that breath mint? And the others groaned. There were codes Ginnika knew, ways of being that she had mastered. Unlike Auntie Uju, Ginnika had come to America with the flexibility and fluidness of youth. The cultural cues had seeped into her skin, and now she went bowling and knew what Toby Maguire was about and found double-dipping gross. Bottles and cans of beer were piling up. They all lounged in glamorous lassitude on the sofa and on the rug, while heavy rock, which Ifemelu thought was unharmonious noise, played on the CD player. Teresa drank the fastest, rolling each empty can of beer on the wood floor, while the others laughed with an enthusiasm that puzzled Ifemelu, because it really was not that funny. How did they know when to laugh, what to laugh about? Ginnika was buying a dress for a dinner party, hosted by the lawyers she was interning with. You should get some things, Ifem. I'm not spending 10 kobo of my money unless I have to. 10 cents. 10 cents. I'll give you a jacket and bedding stuff, but at least you need tights. The cold is coming. I'll manage, Ifemelu said. And she would. If she needed to, she would wear all her clothes at the same time in layers until she found a job. She was terrified to spend money. Ifem, I'll pay for you. It's not as if you're earning much. At least I'm earning some, Ginnika quipped. I really hope I find a job soon.
You will, don't worry.
I don't understand how anybody will believe I'm Ngozi Okonkwo.
Don't show them the license when you go to an interview. Just show the social security card. Maybe they won't even ask. Sometimes they don't for small jobs like that.
Ginnika led the way into a clothing store, which Ifemelu thought too fevered. It reminded her of a nightclub, disco music playing loudly, the interior shadowy, and the salespeople, two thin-armed young women in all black, moving up and down too swiftly. One was chocolate-skinned, her long black weave highlighted with auburn. The other was white, inky hair floating behind her as she came up to them.
Hi, ladies, how are you? Is there anything I can help you with?
She asked in a tinkly sing-song voice. She pulled clothes off hangers and unfurled them from shelves to show Ginnika. Ifemelu was looking at the price tags, converting them to naira, exclaiming,
How can this thing cost this much?
She picked up and carefully examined some of the clothes to find out what each was, underwear or blouse, shirt or dress, and sometimes she was still not certain.
This literally just came in,
the salesperson said of a sparkly dress, as though divulging a big secret, and Ginnika said, "Oh my God, really?" with a great excitement. Under the too bright lighting of the fitting room, Ginnika tried on the dress, walking on tiptoe.
"I love it!"
"But it's shapeless," Ifemelu said. It looked to her like a boxy sack on which a bored person had haphazardly stuck sequins.
"It's postmodern," Ginnika said.
Watching Ginnika preen in front of the mirror, Ifemelu wondered whether she too would come to share Ginnika's taste for shapeless dresses, whether this was what America did to you. At the checkout, the blonde cashier asked, "Did anybody help you?"
"Yes,"
Ginnika said. "Chelsea or Jennifer?"
"I'm sorry, I don't remember her name."
Ginnika looked around to point at her helper, but both young women had disappeared into the fitting rooms at the back.
"Was it the one with long hair?"
the cashier asked.
"Well, both of them had long hair."
"The one with dark hair?"
"Both of them had dark hair." Ginnika smiled and looked at the cashier, and the cashier smiled and looked at her computer screen, and 2 damp seconds crawled past before she cheerfully said,
"It's okay. I'll figure it out later and make sure she gets a commission."
As they walked out of the store, Ifemelu said,
"I was waiting for her to ask, was it the one with 2 eyes or the one with 2 legs? Why didn't she just ask, was it the black girl or the white girl?"
Ginnika laughed.
"Because this is America. You're supposed to pretend that you don't notice certain things."
Ginnika asked Ifemelu to stay with her, to save on rent, but her apartment was too far away, at the end of the main line, and the commuter train taken every day into Philadelphia would cost too much. They looked at apartments together in West Philadelphia. Ifemelu, surprised by the rotting cabinets in the kitchen, the mouse that dashed past an empty bedroom.
"My hostel in Soka was dirty, but there were no rats."
"It's a mouse," Ginnika said.
Ifemelu was about to sign a lease. If saving money meant living with mice, then so be it, when Ginnika's friend told them of a room for rent. A great deal, as college life went. It was in a 4-bedroom apartment with moldy carpeting above a pizza store on Powelton Avenue, on the corner where drug addicts sometimes dropped crack pipes, miserable pieces of twisted metal that glinted in the sun. Ifemelu's room was the cheapest, the smallest, facing the scuffed brick walls of the next building. Dog hair floated around. Her roommates, Jackie, Eleanor, and Allison, looked almost interchangeable, all small-boned and slim-hipped, their chestnut hair ironed straight, their lacrosse sticks piled in the narrow hallway. Eleanor's dog ambled out, large and black, like a shaggy donkey. Once in a while a mound of dog shit appeared at the bottom of the stairs, and Eleanor would scream, "You're in big trouble now, buddy," as though performing for the roommates, playing a role whose lines everyone knew. Ifemelu wished the dog were kept outside, which is where dogs belonged. When Eleanor asked why Ifemelu had not petted her dog or scratched his head in the week since she moved in, she said,
"I don't like dogs."
"Is that a cultural thing?"
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, like, I know in China they eat cat meat and dog meat."
"My boyfriend back home loves dogs. I just don't."
"Oh," Eleanor said, and looked at her, brows furrowed, as Jackie and Allison had earlier looked at her, when she said she had never gone bowling, as though wondering how she could have turned out a normal human being without ever having gone bowling. She was standing at the periphery of her own life, sharing a fridge and a toilet, a shallow intimacy, with people she did not know at all. People who lived in exclamation points.
"Great,"
they said often.
"That's great."
People who did not scrub in the shower. The shampoos and conditioners and gels were cluttered in the bathroom, but there was not a single sponge. And this, the absence of a sponge, made them seem unreachably alien to her. One of her earliest memories was of her mother, a bucket of water between them in the bathroom saying to her,
"Ngwa, scrub between your legs very, very well."
And Ifemelu had applied a little too much vigor with the loofah to show her mother just how clean she could get herself, and for a few days afterwards had hobbled around with her legs spread wide. There was something unquestioning about her roommates' lives, an assumption of certainty that fascinated her, so that they often said, "Let's go get some," about whatever it was they needed. More beer, pizza, buffalo wings, liquor. As though this getting was not an act that required money. She was used at home to people first asking, "Do you have money?" before they made such plans. They left pizza boxes on the kitchen table, and the kitchen itself in casual disarray for days, and on weekends their friends gathered in the living room with packs of beer stacked in the refrigerator and streaks of dried urine on the toilet seat.
"We're going to a party. Come with us, it'll be fun," Jackie said,
and Ifemelu pulled on her slim-fitting trousers and a halter-neck blouse borrowed from Ginnika. "Won't you get dressed?" she asked her roommates before they left, all of them wearing slouchy jeans, and Jackie said,
"We are dressed. What are you talking about?"
with a laugh that suggested yet another foreign pathology had emerged. They went to a fraternity house on Chestnut Street, where everyone stood around drinking vodka-rich punch from plastic cups until Ifemelu accepted that there would be no dancing. To party here was to stand around and drink. They were all a jumble of frayed fabric and slack collars, the students at the party. All their clothes looked determinedly worn. Years later, a blog post would read, "When it comes to dressing well, American culture is so self-fulfilled that it has not only disregarded this courtesy of self-presentation, but has turned that disregard into a virtue. We are too superior, busy, cool, not uptight, to bother about how we look to other people, so we can wear pajamas to school and underwear to the mall." As they got drunker and drunker, some lay limp on the floor, and others took felt-tipped pens and began to write on the exposed skin of the fallen, "Suck me off. Go, Sixers."
"Jackie said you're from Africa," a boy in a baseball cap asked her.
"Yes."
"That's really cool," he said,
and Ifemelu imagined telling Obinze about this, the way she would mimic the boy. Obinze pulled every strand of story from her, going over details, asking questions, and sometimes he would laugh, the sound echoing down the line. She had told him how Allison had said,
"Hey, we're getting a bite to eat, come with us,"
and she thought it was an invitation, and that, as with invitations back home, Allison or one of the others would buy her meal. But when the waitress brought the bill, Allison carefully began to untangle how many drinks each person had ordered, and who had had the calamari appetizer, to make sure nobody paid for anybody else. Ubinze had found this very funny, finally saying,
"That's America for you."
It was, to her, funny only in retrospect. She had struggled to hide her bafflement at the boundaries of hospitality, and also at this business of tipping, paying an extra 15% or 20% of your bill to the waitress, which was suspiciously like bribing, a forced and efficient bribing system. Chapter 13. At first, Ifemelu forgot that she was someone else. In an apartment in South Philadelphia, a tired-faced woman opened the door and led her into a strong stench of urine. The living room was dark, unaired, and she imagined the whole building steeped in months, even years of accumulated urine, and herself working every day in this urine cloud. From inside the apartment, a man was groaning, deep and eerie sounds. They were the groans of a person for whom groaning was the only choice left, and they frightened her.
"That's my dad,"
the woman said, looking at her with keen, assessing eyes.
"Are you strong?"
The advertisement in the city paper had stressed strong.
"Strong home health aid. Pays cash."
"I'm strong enough to do the job," Ifemelu said, and fought the urge to back out of the apartment and run and run.
"That's a pretty accent. Where are you from?"
"Nigeria."
"Nigeria? Isn't there a war going on there?"
"No."
"Can I see your ID?"
the woman asked, and then, glancing at the license, added,
"How do you pronounce your name again?"
"Ifemelu."
"What?"
Ifemelu almost choked.
"Ngozi."
You hum the Really? The woman, with her air of unending exhaustion, seemed too tired to question the two different pronunciations. Can you live in?
Live in?
Yes. Live here with my dad. There's a spare bedroom. You would do 3 nights a week. You'd need to clean him up in the morning.
The woman paused.
You are pretty slight. Look, I've got 2 more people to interview, and I'll get back to you.
Okay. Thank you. Ife Melu knew she would not get the job, and for this she was grateful. She repeated, I'm Ngozi Okonkwo, in front of the mirror before her next interview, at the Sea View restaurant.
Can I call you Goz?
The manager asked after they shook hands, and she said yes. But before she said yes, she paused, the slightest and shortest of pauses, but still a pause, and she wondered if that was why she did not get the job. Later, Ginnika said,
You could have just said, Ngozi is your tribal name, and Ife Melu is your jungle name, and throw in one more as your spiritual name. They believe all kinds of shit about Africa.
Ginnika laughed, a sure, throaty laugh. Ife Melu laughed too, although she did not fully understand the joke, and she had the sudden sensation of fogginess, of a milky web through which she tried to claw. Her autumn of half-blindness had begun, the autumn of puzzlements, of experiences she had knowing there were slippery layers of meaning that eluded her. The world was wrapped in gauze. She could see the shapes of things, but not clearly enough, never enough. She told Obinze that there were things she should know how to do, but didn't, details she should have corralled into her space, but hadn't. And he reminded her of how quickly she was adapting, his tone always calm, always consoling. She applied to be a waitress, hostess, bartender, cashier, and then waited for job offers that never came, and for this she blamed herself. It had to be that she was not doing something right, and yet she did not know what it might be. Autumn had come, wet and grey-skied. Her meagre bank account was leaking money. The cheapest sweaters from Ross, still startled with their high cost. Bus and train tickets added up, and groceries punctured holes in her bank balance, even though she stood guard at the checkout, watching the electronic display and saying, Please stop, I won't be taking the rest, when it got to $30. Each day there seemed to be a letter for her on the kitchen table, and inside the envelope was a tuition bill, and words printed in capital letters. Your records will be frozen unless payment is received by the date at the bottom of this notice. It was the boldness of the capital letters more than the words that frightened her. She worried about the possible consequences, a vague but constant worry. She did not imagine a police arrest for not paying her school fees, but what did happen if you did not pay your school fees in America? Obinze told her nothing would happen, suggested she speak to the bursar about getting on a payment plan so that she would at least have taken some action. She called Obinze often, with cheap phone cards she bought from the crowded store of a gas station on Lancaster Avenue, and just scratching off the metallic dust to reveal the numbers printed beneath, flooded her with anticipation to hear Obinze's voice again. He calmed her. With him, she could feel whatever she felt, and she did not have to force some cheer into her voice, as she did with her parents, telling them she was very fine, very hopeful to get a waitress job, settling down very well with her classes. The highlight of her days was talking to Dike. His voice, higher pitched on the phone, warmed her as he told her what had happened on his TV show, how he had just beaten a new level on Game Boy.
When are you coming to visit, Cos?
He asked often.
I wish you were taking care of me. I don't like going to Miss Brown's. Her bathroom is stinky.
She missed him. Sometimes she told him things she knew he would not understand, but she told him anyway. She told him about her professor, who sat on the grass at lunch to eat a sandwich, the one who asked her to call him by his first name, Al, the one who wore a studded leather jacket and had a motorcycle. On the day she got her first piece of junk mail, she told him,
Guess what? I got a letter today.
The credit card pre-approval, with her name correctly spelled and elegantly italicized, had roused her spirits, made her a little less invisible, a little more present. Somebody knew her. Chapter 14. And then there was Christina Thomas. Christina Thomas, with her rinsed-out look,